Jeff, good morning.
Good morning, Sean. How are you going?
Yeah, very well. Thanks for joining us here on the Daily Program this morning. Now, apart from the obvious human cost, as we mentioned there, 19 lives lost, what is the cost of all this destruction to Indonesia?
Well, I think as you in your introduction, there's a fair amount of financial impost associated with this. Indonesia is a developing nation with a fairly modest income per capita, around about $5,000 per capita. Not a great deal of public infrastructure, so when a disaster like this strikes, clearly it puts enormous stress on the public resources, but also on the private resources of individual villagers and citizens. The costs, you can't really count them up because a lot of the farming areas in which these disasters strike are subsistence with some level of trading on top of that. So it's very difficult to estimate how much it's going to cost. Personal livelihoods, of course, it's huge.
Now, we mentioned, of course, the cyclone causing quite a bit of damage as it swept across the island. We've also got the active volcano, Mount Agung, that is, basically brewing away right now and causing quite a bit of havoc as well. And yet, with these situations in place, as we mentioned, there are still thousands living in these kind of danger areas and not evacuating and, unfortunately, getting caught up in these natural disasters. Why is that? Is it just a case of they have no other option, they have no other choice but to stay where they are?
Choices are limited. Most of these people, as I just said, live in agricultural subsistence farming. And I've got friends whose family live out in the areas around the Agung. Most of them are reluctant to leave their farming areas because obviously there's devastation with neglect. If they move away, then there's going to be all sorts of problems with pestilence and all sorts of damage taking place on their farm. So it's a very, very difficult thing to do. It's very difficult to leave. The accommodation that's being provided, the emergency accommodation, is very limited. Not too many resources, not much public infrastructure again, so they're still going to be relying on the support of family members. And it's just very difficult for them to move away from those areas. There's a lot of historical resonance too, because a lot of the people who live in these areas have deep religious connections with the land. And there's one mage, in fact it's the most important temple in the whole of Bali, is on the slopes of Mount Agung, the Sakya temple, and the religious significance of that, it's all about the whole meaning of life. So it's more than just subsistence farming, it's actually about what it is to be Balinese and the Balinese Hindu religion. So it's a very, very important spiritual place. And many of the people, this happened also in 1963 when the Agung last erupted. A lot of the people have invested their whole lives in this area. They belong to the area. They feel as though the spirits will look after them, the gods will look after them. And even if they perish, there's some kind of meaning in that. So it's very, very difficult to move people away from these places.
And, of course, when we talk about Mount Agung as well, the Bali International Airport, I understand, has reopened following all that havoc we mentioned with tourists' planes caught by thick volcanic ash clouds.
Yeah.
Now, maybe less so in some of the areas we are talking about, but overall in Bali, the tourism is a very, very important part of their economy. How are these kind of natural disasters likely to affect that part of the Balinese economy, the tourism part?
Well, the reason why the Negara Rai Airport was able to reopen was because of a shift in the trade winds, and that means now that the winds are going to be blowing from the west, blowing the ash away from the tourist zones of Badung, which is where most people go around the Kuta Legian areas, the newer areas. So to that extent, I think the worst of it is possibly over. It's hard to know. These volcanoes are really unpredictable. It settled down a little bit, but there's still some seismic activity, some earthquake activity, and the next bout may be even more serious than the eruption that just took place. So, yes, it's going to have an impact on tourism. I suspect people will be thinking twice about whether they want to go to Bali at the moment, but I suspect the next few months, with the wind blowing in the opposite direction, I think the Badung area, the tourist area in the southwest, that'll be reasonably okay. I think the airport will be reasonably okay, and that should be the case for a few more months. But it's very hard to know. Whenever anything like this happens to a tourist economy, clearly there's an impact. And no doubt the people in the tourist authority will be wondering and doing some calculations about what it's already cost. But yeah, there will be an impact there as well.
And just finally, when we talk about those kind of calculations, cyclones, volcanoes, these other kind of natural disasters, what do you feel could actually be done in future to lessen the impact? I guess lessen the impact both for the human cost in terms of lives lost, but also the economic cost for Bali and homes and such lost as well. Do you think there are steps that could be taken?
Well, the only thing I think the best we can do is, as Australians supporting our Indonesian cousins, the best we can do is support their public and emergency infrastructure. That's the best way we can manage these. Something like a cyclone where those 19 people died, most of them, as you said, were in a landslide. There's all sorts of things that could have been done to support those people in terms of emergency services. So I think investment, public investment or foreign aid investment in emergency services would be really valuable. We've done a little bit of that anyway in Bali after the Bali bombings. We've done some support of that, but this is what we could do. The Indonesians themselves, again, because of their own income, the national income, it's difficult for them to invest too much money into that. In terms of moving people away from those danger zones permanently, I think that's probably not possible. I mean, Indonesia has a population density of around about 134 people per square kilometre. Australia has about 3. So you can see just that population density makes it really difficult to move people about in Indonesia. And these are fertile areas on the west side of Mount Agung. It's really fertile soil. So that's the attraction there. On the east side, which is incredibly impoverished, on the east side of Agung, where they don't get much rainfall and the soils are thin, we could be doing more to help them through foreign aid and support. They should be moved away. That's a really difficult thing to say because people live in these zones, as I explained, for religious reasons as well. But we could probably invest in support there as well so that mobility becomes easier.
Well, Jeff, thank you very much. Really appreciate your time this morning.
No worries, Sean.
That was Professor Jeff Lewis in Media and Communications at RMIT University discussing with us the current situation in Indonesia regarding those natural disasters that have struck in Indonesia.